Thanks for joining us today as we take a look at some of the efforts of the International Crane Foundation to reestablish, restore, keep going the crane populations that we have here in the state and elsewhere as well. I'm Larry Mueller. Ann Lacey, my guest today, she's the Crane Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation. She's the leading expert in North America on crane species. She's been with the organization for 16 years. It's great to have her. Thanks so much for joining us. Great to have you with us, Ann.
It is my pleasure. Thank you.
I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. You may have questions about cranes. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And, you know, we haven't, you know, I've had representatives on from the International Crane Foundation several times, but it's been a long time since we've actually talked about what the Crane Foundation does. I think many people know, but it's worth it for new listeners and so as a reminder to us old listeners.
Sure. We are the International Crane Foundation. Yeah. So there's 15 species of crane worldwide, and only two of them happen in North America. So we do a lot of work worldwide and from little old Baraboo, Wisconsin. So it's quite something, the history that where we've come from. We're 40 years an organization, 40 plus years, and still going strong.
And visiting the Crane Foundation is just the coolest.
Well, thank you very much.
Coolest thing ever. Yes, we'd love to stop by.
I would agree. And our opening day is April 15th, so forget about tax day.
Yeah.
And come on in and visit us. We're open every day from April 15th to October 31st. And it's a great place to bring kids and adults, children of all ages.
Just as an aside on the last time and pretty much every time I come, when we go out to that circular kind of area
where we call the pod.
You walk up to the sort of the fence area, and if there's a crane quite a long ways into the fence, they will come walking right up to you.
They will come right up. That's their territory, their home, and they will defend it vociferously.
But it's so much fun to have a crane, I mean, a couple feet away from you.
And they look you in the eye.
Yes,
they look you in the eye. You're very happy for that fence.
Well, I tell you what, you're doing some great research. Let's talk about the fact that the program's been in the news a lot lately.
Yes. Yeah.
Regarding changes to some of the techniques that you've been using to raise chicks, among other things.
Yeah, so speaking specifically of whooping cranes, so sandhills are the most numerous crane species in the world, and so they're doing very, very well. And they occur here in Wisconsin, and most people are familiar with those. But we also have whooping cranes in Wisconsin, and that is part of a reintroduced population. So we call that project the Whooping Crane Eastern Partnership. And it's 15 years going strong also, but there has been some, well, not setbacks, but they're not breeding nearly as well as we would like them to. So we really had to do some introspective thinking and, you know, what are some changes that we can do to try to affect change 3 to 5 years down the line when these birds are becoming parents. And so that's, oh boy, does it take patience. And for someone who doesn't have much patience, you want to see immediate results. And that's difficult. So this is the first year where we're really going to step back to try to not interact with the birds as much as people in costume. We're going to let real whooping cranes in captivity raise chicks, and then we're going to put them out in the wild in the company of older birds that are already out there on the landscape and have them teach them the migration route and see how that affects the birds years down the line.
And so the migration route, of course, then we're not going to have the human-powered.
Correct. Yeah, the Operation Migration is still a strong member of this partnership, and they're helping us out in other ways with those ultralights. They can do monitoring, and they have an extraordinary volunteer force up and down the flyway that can help us when these birds do migrate. And so it's been several years now that these birds are not going all the way to Florida. They're doing much like the sandhills are doing, and they're choosing their own place to winter based on, you know, whatever flips or trigger when they get there. If it's a safe place, good wetlands, good foraging areas, then absolutely.
They're going to stop right there.
And we'll let them. As long as they're in a safe place, that's a good choice.
Talking with Ann Lacey today, the Crane Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation. Certainly looking forward to hearing from you. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show with questions or experiences to share. Jerry on Facebook commented that he drove through White River Marsh yesterday and saw, he thought, over 50 sandhill cranes.
Oh, yeah, at least that many.
Yeah, he had the reports of several hoopers already there as well.
Exactly. That's one of their home bases, because that is one of the places that they're reared. Even though they're people in costume rearing them, the birds will see that as their home place, and they will often come back there, disperse out however far from that area, but that's what they would call home on their return from migration.
And how many hoopers do we have in the state?
Well, in the population right now, in the Eastern Flyway, we estimate right now, we still have a pretty good handle on where all of them are, but there's about 110 now.
You know, it's too bad that we can keep track of all of them, that there are so few.
Isn't
nationally.
That a blessing and a curse? It's pretty extraordinary that we have one of the most endangered bird species in the world here in Wisconsin, and this particular subset, this population, we know so much about them, literally from before they were hatched, their genetics, through to if they happen to die and we find them, we know how they died. That's extraordinary data set.
Do you think it's feasible to reestablish a migrating population of whooping?
Oh, it's possible. Anything's possible. No, it's hard. It's been shown many times. It's very difficult to reestablish cranes. But this one is doing good if we can just kind of figure out what the issue might be with reproduction.
Yeah, and I'm trying to figure that out.
Yep, plenty of theories. And again, you know, we're doing a lot. Every year we have research that goes on. Could be a high amount of predation. It could be low nest attendance by the adults. Maybe they're not quite sure, and they can get over that in practice. So we have a multitude of research projects going on trying to measure these things. But again, when you have a low number in the population, it's hard to discern results when you have a very low sample size. So some of it is still speculation.
And with that few, you got to be careful, too, not to disrupt.
Exactly. Yeah, we have to use non-invasive means because we don't want to be the source of the disruption. So we try to approach them from afar and let them do what they can do naturally and encourage them to the extent that we can. And then we still supplement them and putting these birds out in the landscape that are trained perhaps by different methods and see if that makes a different effect 5 to 10 years down the line when those birds become breeding adults.
Are there eggs yet? We have any eggs?
There are. We actually have whooping crane nests out there. We counted 16 on the last aerial flight. The Wisconsin DNR does aerial flights for us. It's fabulous. And so that's great information. And so we know that they've already been nesting for about a week.
And of the total of 100 nationally, how many of them wind up here in Wisconsin?
Oh, that's just the eastern population.
Okay.
So the birds in the central flyway, what we call the natural population, the original whooping crane population that breeds in Wood Buffalo National Park way up in Canada,
yeah,
and winters in the coast of Texas at Aransas National Wildlife Refuge, they're over 300 now, and they're still gradually increasing. And so a lot of our work also is really, really focused on the Texas coast, ensuring freshwater inflows that are critical to their wintering, and then looking at the hazards throughout the flyway. That migration that they undertake is pretty hazardous. There's all sorts of things that they can literally and figuratively run into along that migration route. So we do work there, too.
Boy, when you get that small a number, you know, I start immediately thinking about genetics and inbreeding, or I don't know how
yeah,
big a problem that is for cranes, but...
Well, then you think about when the original population of whooping cranes was counted in the 1950s, 40s and 50s, there were 15 birds, 1-5, in the entirety of the population. So now, all of the genetics in the original population, the reintroduced populations in the eastern flyway in Louisiana, and all of the captive birds, 600-ish birds in the world, it's a pretty shallow gene pool.
Yeah.
So you ask geneticists, they say, well, you know, inbreeding is a relative term. That's very, very inbred, but we're doing our best. There's a lot of math involved.
I bet. Bob couldn't hold on, but he was wondering about population growth of sandhill cranes. How much has that increased?
It is very difficult to actually count, you know, the number of sandhill cranes, but we do assist the Fish and Wildlife Service and the eastern population to try and count those birds in the fall. And the estimates are up towards 70, 80,000 in the eastern flyway, and they have greatly expanded. And we actually just published a paper on the distribution and expansion of the eastern population of sandhill cranes in the both the breeding grounds and the wintering grounds. And it's pretty astounding information that we have gotten there from the breeding bird survey and the Christmas bird count, so citizen science at its best. And it's what we can kind of guesstimate for Wisconsin is that the population might be leveling off. So it's not growing out of control necessarily. It's still growing, but slowly, steadily.
I'm looking at, I'm just absolutely amazed looking at the maps from that research. And this is over about a century, isn't it?
It started, our data set goes back to 1965. That was the first breeding bird survey. So the Christmas bird count obviously has more than that. And so we just divided it up arbitrarily into four equal time frames. And you can see that as the population has grown, they have expanded out from Wisconsin. But the density of the breeding birds has always, the center of that population has always been in Wisconsin, even though we know that there's birds breeding in New England and even up into Quebec. Mm-hmm. But the wintering areas, they're wintering now everywhere from right here in Wisconsin. winter is a relative term. Yeah. All the way, they still go down to Florida. We find our birds in Louisiana, Tennessee, Kentucky, a lot in Indiana. So they're breeding all up and down the East Coast.
Yeah, it's almost a solid line from Wisconsin all the way to Florida's tip.
If there's a good wetland complex, there's likely to be a good population of wintering cranes in that area.
And along that line, I don't think there's a state that's not represented.
Yeah, the only place you might not find them are the sandy pine forests of Mississippi and into Alabama, but that's about it. Yeah.
Wow. Talking with Ann Lacy, give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And I'll get Rob and Prairie du Chien up right now. Just caught up. Let's get him on. Rob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey. I was questioning, how many eggs do they lay, the whooping crane?
Most crane species only lay two eggs at a time.
Okay. Only once a year?
If they lose their nest by whatever reason, floods or predation, and it's early enough, they can recycle and they can produce at least one and sometimes another two eggs, but usually only they can do that twice.
Do you ever interfere with it and incubate? Can you incubate one egg just to up the population? Or are they possible to incubate?
Yeah, that is a big part of the project to help out the whooping crane population. One of the theories why they did not do very well nesting early on is because they were harassed by black flies. And most people in Wisconsin can feel the pain of a whooping crane.
Oh.
Not necessarily if you're out there sitting on a nest, but anybody who's out in any kind of wetland area can appreciate the horror of black fly season. And you can imagine sitting on an egg and you have no place to go and they're driven off of a nest. So what we've tried doing is taking those eggs right prior to when we estimate black flies will emerge. We can then use those eggs. We bring them into our captive breeding centers, and we use those to raise. And previously, we use those and we raise them as people in costume and re-put them back out onto the landscape. This year, we will give them to older whooping cranes in captivity to be raised. So that helps supplement the population that way. And the birds that we took the eggs from will reclutch. They'll lay another set of eggs after the black flies have left the landscape, and then they can raise those two chicks, hopefully two, at least one, on their own.
How many days does it take for the hatch?
They incubate for 30 days, so they're sitting out there in weather like this or 70-degree days sometimes for 30 days.
I built one of your specialty buildings. I was a foreman on the job.
Oh, excellent.
Before the whooping crane.
Ah, thank you.
Curious on how things were going.
Out in Crane City?
Yeah, on the back side to the right when you pull in. One of the WIC buildings.
Oh, sure, sure. Our isolation ring facility, and that's where we raise our whooping cranes for release into the wild. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks, Rob.
All right.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. Ann Lacey, our guest as we talk about the International Crane Foundation and our cranes. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and her guests will be discussing the results of yesterday's primary election. We're taking a look at the results of some crane research right now and talking cranes in general with our guest, Ann Lacey of the International Crane Foundation. Again, you can join us at Open Lines, get you on pretty quickly with your own questions or maybe your experiences to share about cranes. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And let's turn to Jody in Waupaca next. Jody, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, good morning. This is a good topic. It's the cranes. I live in central Wisconsin. We have, I think, all the sandhill cranes migrate to our farm. They're beautiful, but they cause havoc. The produce that we raise on the farm for our produce market last year had to be replanted three times because they come in, and once it starts to grow, they'll go right down the row and eat all the corn. And even when we purchased the product to put on the seeds, and it's quite expensive, they still ate the corn. So as beautiful as they are, I think we need to do something about population control on these sandhill cranes. And I'll take your comments off air, and I know that's not probably a popular comment, but...
Well, no, I think it's an all right, because there's been a lot of research over time on how to resolve that issue, Jody. So you raise a perfectly legitimate question.
Absolutely, in this state. I mean, we're our agricultural background here, and we've done a lot of work. When I started at the Crane Foundation, that's the project that I was working on, helping to develop that product that Jody was talking about. It is called Avapel, and that is available for purchase for farmers to treat corn. And I'm not quite sure what happened in your case, Jody, but you know, in my research, I've seen those cranes dig up a corn seed that is treated with that, and it's a bitter taste.
Right, it's bitter.
Yeah,
it's, the first two times we tried something else, and then we got the Avapel or whatever. It's pink, and finally, but you know, there are so many sandhill cranes.
Yes.
On our farm.
Yep.
That we really need to do something. Everybody's always concerned about the deer population, but they forget, like, there's another population.
There's another population out there.
That has done very, very well. So a couple of things for that very salient point. I mean, sandhill cranes were nearly extirpated in the state. And so the same thing that makes our state so fabulous for agriculture and such a strong agricultural state is the same thing that led to the success and recovery of sandhill cranes. We have that rich, fertile soil, those farm fields that the birds like because it's flat and they can see things coming, and so they feel safe there, and they're right next to wetlands where they need to roost in the evening in the water, and they build their nests. So the thing to think about, though, is when we're talking, you know, and population control is a catch-all, but what we would need to do to a sandhill crane population to make damage, at least reduce it, I mean, not make it go away, but to reduce it, we would have to decimate the population. And I don't even know if that's possible. It's not very realistic. So that's why we really, really try hard to make sure that all farmers know that they have an option to use this seed treatment, that there's other things. You know, scare tactics don't really work with sandhill cranes.
Yeah.
They are too smart. But sometimes, you know, you just need to get them out of that field for that 2 weeks that the corn is vulnerable. You know, it's... Most of my job is outsmarting cranes and, if you know, keeping one step ahead of them. And so that's what I actually try to help people do. You know, people call all the time. They have them picking at their screens, digging up their corn, digging up their yard. And we just try to work together to try to solve that problem.
And thanks, Jody, for bringing that up. Certainly worth talking about. And good to know that there's some research going on to really kind of help the problem. Jennifer in Madison has something for us. Jennifer, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry.
I was recently in Bhutan, and I'm sure your guest knows about the refuge there for black-necked cranes.
Yes.
It was wonderful to see these birds, and I know they're somewhat threatened because of environmental issues primarily. Mm-hmm. But what I wanted to say is that as a traveler, I often have to explain where Wisconsin is, what Wisconsin is. People don't generally know that. But when I was there where the black-necked cranes are, I said, I live near the International Crane Foundation. And the director was almost reverential. He said, oh, you are from Barabu? Well, close enough, yes.
And the Mecca equivalent for cranes, I think, yes.
Yeah, they're thrilled with the work you're doing, of course. So oh. It was nice to hear that over there.
I'm glad that you went on the Bhutan trip. That is a wonderful one. The Pajibka Valley.
Yes, beautiful place.
Yeah.
You can hear the birds as the sun is coming up before you see them. They're out there already, and they are pretty vocal.
Yes, they are. all cranes are. They're a wonderful bird. Alarm clock.
Yes, yes. So I just wanted to let you know your work is appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks a lot, Jennifer, for calling. Speaking of sounds, let's listen to it. Here's a crane.
And our Craniac students out there will know that's a unison call of a pair of cranes. That was great.
A pair of sandhill cranes. Let's go to Dave in Delavan next. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a fantastic show. My wife and I are members of the Crane Foundation.
We've been up here, Dave,
to visit it. Fabulous work you're doing. Thank you so much.
I appreciate that.
I thought unique experience this winter. When we've spotted cranes in the past, it's typically been a couple, maybe three. I was out shoveling my driveway, and I heard that wonderful, unmistakable call. I looked up, and the sky was filled with cranes. There had to be 40 of them, and they were flying like erratically in two groups, like they couldn't agree with each other on which direction to go. They were swooping all around. It was magnificent. I ran in the house, got my camera. I came out, and I don't have the best camera. I'm not a great photographer. And, of course, they were a little too far away to really get a decent shot. I got a bunch of specs. But it was magnificent. I loved it. I put the camera back in the house. The cranes left the area. And then I was down the block shoveling my neighbor's driveway out. And all of a sudden, I heard them again, and I looked up, and they were passing overhead, I would say not more than 25 or 30 feet over my head.
And you didn't have your camera then.
Didn't have my camera.
That's always the case. It sounds like they were trying to find some place to land if it was cold and snowy. Their choices were slim.
Yes.
But what a great experience.
Oh, I saw every detail very closely and, of course, without the camera.
Yep. Memories. Perfect.
Oh,
thank you, Dave.
Dave, thanks for calling. Interesting experience. It was actually a wonderful experience. Sometimes it's just nice to look and not shoot a picture.
Yep, not worry about getting that perfect shot, but just enjoy that sound. You can hear the wind literally in their wings, their feathers on the downstroke. You can hear that. It's wonderful.
Elizabeth in Richland Center will give you a chance. Hi, Elizabeth.
Well, hi. I think we have city cranes. Oh, early this spring, I heard we'd camp at the river, so I know what the sound is. And here, I could hear that noise, and by the time I could get outside, I could never see them. I'm 84 years old. I'm pretty slow. So anyway, one day my husband says, come on, hurry up and look. And we live in a mobile home park. And if you know Richland Center, we have the American Legion with our 300 flags. Mm-hmm. And in the field just before that, there they were, a pair of cranes. And I just call them our city cranes.
Sandhill cranes are there. One of the reasons why they're so successful in our state is they're generalists, and they're very tolerant of people. So they'll get used to being in people's backyards and sometimes in urbanish areas where they might not be quite so safe. But, yep, you'll see them, and as long as there's water for them, they'll be there.
Yeah. Thanks, Elizabeth. Appreciate your call. And I want to give Dave, calling from McAllen, Texas, a chance to join us. Hi, Dave.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I was wondering where your International Crane Foundation gets most of its funding and what the public, I guess, can do, whether it's organizations or individuals, to help support what you're doing financially.
Oh, thank you, Dave. That's wonderful. One of the easiest ways is to become a member, and our website, savingcranes.org, has lots of options for that. And we have an annual Members Day every year in the fall, and that's the one day a year where you can go behind the scenes and see some of the breeding areas that are normally closed to the public. But even every other day, you can come and tour our trails and stuff. But for somebody from McAllen, Texas, who can also become a member, you get a newsletter that describes all of our work around the world. Most of our funding, however, comes from, because of the nature of our organization, we have many endangered species. So we receive a lot of funding from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to take care of mostly whooping cranes, but other endangered species. And we rely very heavily on grants from private foundations. And so that's where we have a crack team that is helping people like me, who are not very good at writing, write the grants to help us do our work all over the world. So that's another very critical source for us as well.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Very good.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I wanted to mention the Midwest Crane Count is coming up soon.
It is.
And we haven't talked about that. So
yeah. Our opening day is Friday, April 15th, and the very next day at 5:30 in the morning, if you're so inclined, please get up and go to a wetland near you or even not near you and listen for cranes. And that information on how to be involved in the crane count is right on our homepage also, savingcranes.org. And so that has been going on now for, it's almost as old as ICF itself. It's over 30 years old as well. And we're in six states in the upper Midwest. But our data now is being collected into eBird. And a lot of birders will know what that is. And if you're not a birder, it's sponsored by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And
it's a really cool site.
A stunning database of bird information. And so all of our data is going into that. And that's citizen science. So calling all citizen scientists, come out on April 16th for the crane count.
And all of the directions on what to do and all that are on your site.
Absolutely. Right down to every detail, how to find a coordinator in your county to be assigned a wetland, if you go out to a wetland, how to enter your data and what to do with it. And you can always contact us at the Crane Foundation if you're confused on what to do or need more information. Please do.
Please do. And we have a link on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show as well. So if you didn't get that down, you can just go to our Facebook page and you can go right to the link from there. Jim in Baraboo has a comment. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Larry. This is, I live on the Wisconsin River between the Dells and Portage. So we definitely see our share of cranes out here.
Oh, in the fall. Absolutely. It's a major staging area. Yeah,
and we also have the birders also come out here and sit in their front yard, and they take the bird count as well as crane counts and things like that. So we're pretty involved with that.
Excellent.
Quite a few years ago, my one grandson's grown up now, but my wife used to help out over at the Crane Foundation, and it was Alex. Alex is his name, and he won a contest over there once and we got that hanging on our refrigerator, a picture of him.
Fabulous.
I don't know if he had a dress. I think we dressed up with the cranes, and then you go over to the, I think it's the Far East building or something where the cranes were, and they walk around behind you and things like that, the young ones. So it's been real interesting for living out here and to see as many cranes as we do. And yeah. I'm involved a little bit with the Leopold Foundation.
Sure, you're right there too.
Mm-hmm. Right, we're a block away from the Ella Leopold Foundation. And they were quite concerned when they were putting some of these high lines in. I don't know if they got them to move any of them or change the position of some of them, but they're pretty dangerous to cranes, as you well know. So.
That's mm-hmm. Thank you, Jim. That's a very good point. That is another research project that I am involved with, actually, that there is a high-powered transmission line that is going to go right down Interstate 9094 parallels the Wisconsin River between the river and the International Crane Foundation, actually. And all of those cranes that Jim sees on the river in the fall, that stage, this year we had between 10 and 12,000 cranes in that one spot this year. They would have to they cross over the interstate and they go to their foraging areas. And all of them would be at great risk from that power line, potentially, for collision. It's one of a major sources of mortality for them.
Right, right.
Yep, and we're working with the company to make sure that we do the best that we can to lower those power lines, to mark them, to see what kind of effect it has on the cranes. And so they've been a great partner to work with in making sure that that is the least possible risk for cranes.
Jim, thank you so much for calling. I want to give some others a chance to get in. I appreciate your comments and your reporting on your sightings as well. Just to go along with that, James on Facebook says he's heard about windmills creating problems, wind farms. Any research going on in that area?
There is, actually, directly with cranes. And it is true that, in general, birds are very much at risk from wind farms. But a lot of birds migrate at night, and that puts them at very great risk. For cranes, because they operate mostly in daylight hours, they can see these wind farms. So a bigger risk, it's a very, very low risk of collision. It does happen, but it's a very, very low risk. More of a risk is that it takes an area that they might use as a foraging area, and it removes that from their choice. Mm. And so it makes them perhaps choose a less desirable area, or makes them fly even further to a foraging area. But also with wind farms comes power lines. And so we try to make sure that they do sight them very, very well. Where there's wind, there are flyways. And so that's a difficult task. But we do try to make them really, really make the best possible choice for the power lines and for the wind farms.
And Tim in Sturgeon Bay has something for us. Hi, Tim. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I lived in South Dakota for a year, and they have a hunting season for sandhill cranes. And I know Wisconsin has discussed it in the past. My question is, why isn't it federally regulated like waterfowl?
Oh, boy. I'm not sure that I can answer that. I think, especially in the central flyway, there has been hunting seasons on sandhills. Every state but Nebraska, actually, and for people that have been to the Platte River in March, which I highly recommend that you go visit to see the cranes, that would be the reason why there's no hunting there, that there are federally created management plans for the species, and then the states set up their timing and areas. So, and that happens also in the eastern flyway. We now have a management plan for sandhill cranes in the eastern flyway, and there are two states, small areas in Kentucky and Tennessee, where sandhill cranes can be legally hunted. And so it's up to each state to take that management plan then and incorporate it into their state game laws. That's my best answer.
Is it a viable management tool then, in your opinion?
As a management tool?
Is it viable?
Yeah, I don't believe that. I don't see a hunting season as a management tool. Can sandhill cranes be sustainably harvested? Yes. Is that the best use of that resource? That's up to everybody's personal opinion. I know quite a few people that would much rather look at sandhill cranes through binoculars. Mm-hmm. And there's sandhill crane and now whooping crane festivals all over the U.S. And that is a big economic push as well. So there's every argument to be made that kind of consumption is as economically viable as a hunting season.
There we go. Thanks a lot, Tim, for calling. And Jill in Rhinelander, you have a question. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. We had a pair of sandhill cranes we suspect nested. We didn't find the nest or go looking for it, as a matter of fact, but they were here.
they're back again in the snow, and they're pretty disappointed, I guess.
Rethinking their choices, yes.
Really. But they would come in, it was during the early spring, one at a time. They were here, both of them together, then one at a time, and then they disappeared for a while. Then they came back, and there were two adults and two smaller ones, but they weren't real little babies.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if they go sequester someplace, and why they didn't bring their young ones in to the food source when they were small.
You have described the quintessential summer ritual for sandhills. So when you see them one at a time, we know that a pair is nesting because they take turns on the nest incubating those eggs for 30 days. When the chicks hatch, they're pretty tiny, and they're mobile after 24 hours, but they still can't go too far, depending on what their territory is composed of. And so they will, if it's a very productive territory, meaning there's lots of food items, they don't need to go very far. But when they get bigger and they're able to be more mobile, and that's when all of a sudden you see them. So maybe there was just too much vegetation or shrubbery that they didn't want to try to negotiate with a small crane chick. And so you saw them when those chicks were big enough to come into the area, and they obviously know that your backyard is a very safe place, and so they can wander around, and it's nice and open and safe for them.
There we go. Thank you very much, Joe, for calling. Appreciate that very much. And Ann, boy, this has been great. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I love this.
It's been a lot of fun. Any last words? I think, I'd like to have you remind folks about the foundation itself and how to find it.
Sure. Again, in this internet age, thank you, internet, for answering all of our questions. Savingcranes.org. You can find information on how to find us, our hours and admissions and membership information, crane count information. Follow us on Facebook. You don't need to be a member of Facebook or Twitter. Just follow Saving Cranes #. Lots of great pictures. Despite what he said before, there's a million great crane pictures out there, and we have a lot of them. It's just a ton of information on our international work. And that paper with those pictures that Larry talked about, and that paper that we just wrote on the distribution of Sandhill cranes
is up, and that map is really tells the story.
I was flabbergasted, just seeing things visually like that. It tells you how great sandhills are. They're adaptable.
They're pretty darn adaptable.
And we're hoping the same for those whooping cranes.
Thank you so much, Anna, and look forward to your next visit.
I look forward to it. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Ann Lacey is the crane research coordinator for the International Crane Foundation, and man, they do some wonderful work. And if you have a chance to visit, tell me again, when do you open again for public?
April 15th.
Oh, April, tax day.
No, not tax day. It's opening day at the International Crane Foundation.
There we go. Well, coming up, it's going to be pretty soon it's going to be opening day for the varsity band concert at the University of Wisconsin. And we'll find out about the UW Varsity Band and that concert next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.